We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. My name is Stephen Lyons, and today we have the pleasure of talking with Laurie Hertzell, the author of the memoir News to Me, Adventures of an Accidental Journalist. Let me remind you, this is a recorded interview, so we will not be taking any phone calls this morning. The book is published by the University of Minnesota Press. That same press published a previous book by Laurie titled They Took My Father, Finnish Americans in Stalin's Russia. Our guest was born in Louisville, Kentucky, but grew up in Duluth, Minnesota on Lake Superior, and spent nearly 20 years at the Duluth News Tribune in almost every position: newsroom clerk, librarian, copy editor, beat reporter, feature writer, news editor, and columnist. But one job she did not perform was to make coffee. More about that in a minute. Laurie has won many awards for her journalism and for her fiction, including the Thomas Wolfe Fiction Prize. Currently, Laurie is the books editor of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, where I must confess she is forced to edit my work from time to time. News to Me is getting rave reviews. The Charlotte Observer calls it charming and wistful, praising the author as a powerful storyteller who engagingly invokes the romantic world while also tracking its decline in the age of the Internet. News to Me invokes a period of time in newspaper offices that many of us in journalism will remember, perhaps not well, but will remember. Pica poles and cropping wheels, editing on plasticky paper with those odd blue pens, messy wax machines and frantic paste-ups on light tables. And oh, then there's those nasty X-Acto blades. By the way, a word to the wise, do not wear sandals when using X-Acto blades. And then the evolution in journalism into big, clunky, chunky computers, and now the great realignment of newspapers brought on by the Internet. Yet, as News to Me shows so brilliantly, I think there's a human side to all of this. For example, reporters like Laurie Hertzell and thousands of others who've made newspapers their careers. They poured their hearts and souls into bringing us the news. And they have arrived at newsrooms through different ways. Here's Laurie Hertzell describing one such path. When it comes right down to it, I did everything wrong. You're supposed to actively choose journalism as your career. Then you go to J school, as journalism majors call it, work on the college newspaper, get a couple internships under your belt, and graduate. Graduating's kind of key. After that, you go to work at a weekly or a small daily, hop to a slightly larger paper, maybe go to grad school. Eventually, you end up at the big time. This is not how I did it. This is not how the old guys I worked with had done it. They'd fallen into journalism after careers in public relations or teaching or tending bar, or one of them, after serving a term or two as the mayor of Duluth. Journalism was seen in those years as a craft, something any smart and curious person could learn on the job. But by the mid-1980s, when Larry Fortner callously tossed me over to the reporting side, journalism had become a profession with a very distinct and proper career path. Laurie has witnessed it all, and I'm delighted to have her with us today. Welcome to Focus 580, Laurie.
Thank you so much.
Now, you're in the books room at the great Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Yeah.
And can you describe your surroundings?
Well, I'm in the basement, and it's kind of a dark and treacherous path to get here. The basement is full of abandoned computers and old desks and big scraps of paper, and there's mice down here as well. And you have to kind of make your way to the middle of the basement, and there's a locked door, and you open the door and turn on the light, and there's this wonderful room, and this is where I am. I have floor-to-ceiling metal bookcases that go around three walls, and they are filled with galleys and some completed books from June of this year into March of next year.
Mm.
So it's crowded, but it's my place, and I love it down here.
Mice, Minnesota mice. Can't beat those. They have woolens on already, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's nippy today.
Laurie, I really related to this book, both as a lapsed newspaper reporter, but also as a consumer of news. What was the inspiration for this book? I understand you were working on something entirely different.
I was. I had asked for a month off, an unpaid leave, a couple of years ago, because I had read Marley and Me, and I thought, you know, I got dogs. I could write about my dogs. I could make $1 million. You know, why not? So I think my bosses thought I was kind of crazy, but they were very nice, and they gave me the month off. And I started writing about my dogs and realized that my dogs were just, you know, I love them, but they weren't that interesting. And so that kind of went nowhere. But at the same time, I was writing a blog, which I still write. It's called Three Dog Blog. And I started telling stories of the old days of newspapers just for fun. It's a blog I started 3 or 4 years ago because I hadn't been writing regularly. I've been an editor now for 15 years, and I missed writing, and I wanted something to make me write every day. So I started this blog, and it's just a storytelling blog. It's stories of my life. And so I started telling these stories of the old days of journalism just sort of for fun, and the people who read my blog seemed to really like these stories, and they kept asking for more. So I wrote more, and they asked for more, and eventually it became a book.
And did you make your $1 million?
Not yet, but any day now.
There's a whole genre of dog books, and we don't have time to talk about that, but it's been interesting as a book reviewer myself to see the evolution of dog books.
Mm-hmm.
In an interview that was posted last month on the Newman Storyboard, you said that news to me is, quote, the story of a young woman who fell into something quite by accident and found that she loved it. I wonder if you could explain what you meant by that.
Well, I never had any intention to be a newspaper reporter. I always knew that I loved to write. I had loved writing from the time I was very small. My father was an English professor. My mother was a librarian. Our house was full of books and magazines all the time. And I had been writing stories, you know, from the time I was a little kid. I never thought much of newspapers. I never really considered newspapers to be written. You know, they just seemed so formulaic and kind of boring and gray. So it was not something I ever considered. But when I was 19, I had a job at the public library, shelving books, and was making 95 cents an hour, which was way below minimum wage. But for some reason, the city was allowed to pay less than minimum wage. So I needed a job that paid better because I was in college. And my boss suggested, she said, what about newspapers or TV stations? You know, she was thinking creatively, and I thought, oh, that sounds like fun. And it turned out that the newspapers in Duluth, the Duluth News Tribune, which was the morning paper, and the Duluth Herald, which was the afternoon paper, they were looking for a newsroom clerk, someone to answer phones and open the mail and take obits and run errands and that sort of thing. And I applied for the job, and, you know, the minute I walked in the newsroom, I just thought, what a fascinating place, because here was this room. It was full of desks and noise and busy people kind of, you know, trotting back and forth with their coffee mugs and their pica poles and shouting into the telephone and you know, stacks of newspapers, and it just seemed like a great place. And I was very excited, and I took the typing test, and I met everybody, and then I didn't get the job. And I was crushed. Suddenly, I wanted nothing more than to work in this place that I had not known existed. And about a week later, they called me up and said that the person they had hired had already quit. So I got the job.
Was there a little bit of secondhand cigarette smoke in the cigar smoke in that office?
It was blue with cigarette smoke. Everybody smoked. Some people had, you know, I mean, it's like the cliches. This was not a 1940s newsroom. You know, they were not using those old black manual typewriters, but they were using electric typewriters. And some guys did have, you know, whiskey bottles in their desk drawers. And I never saw them drink on the job, but I saw the bottles. I know they were there. Mm-hmm. Everybody smoked, and it was almost all men. I started working there in 1976, and it was just beginning to turn. It was really a great time to start there because it was just on the cusp of change. You know, they had just hired, maybe a month or two before they hired me, they had hired a couple of young women, young college-educated women who were, you know, liberated and, you know, going to change the world, and they were dropped into this sea of middle-aged, balding, you know, white men, and it was very interesting.
Hmm. Two newspapers for a city of, what, a little over 100,000 at that time?
That's right, yeah.
a morning and an evening newspaper. That that really shows you how far we've changed or evolved or devolved in any case. And we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
And you come from a large family, correct?
Yes, I have 9 siblings.
Hmm. Any of them in newspapers or publishing?
No, I'm the only one. A couple professors. I have a brother who works in printing. He manages a printing company. But no, I'm the only writer.
Okay. I remember the late poet William Matthews advising me once that memory is a poor guide to the past. And you related a story in an interview about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and this is where we would cue Gordon Lightfoot, and how your memory of that sinking served as a cautionary tale for your own recollections as you began the research of this book.
Yes, that was horrifying. For those listeners who don't remember, the Edmund Fitzgerald was a big ore boat on Lake Superior that sank in a terrible storm one November. November is always a very... You know, it's one of those months when the seasons are changing very dramatically, going from fall into winter, and there's terrible storms on the lake. And in my memory, I remembered very vividly working at the News Tribune the day that the Fitzgerald sank. And the reason I remembered it was because one of the copy editors came up to me and showed me a picture of an ore boat and said, "You have to make sure if someone asks you to pull a picture from the morgue of a boat, that you pick the right boat. You can't just take any old ore boat and think that, you know, nobody's going to know the difference, because the people who have family on these boats know their boats by the shape and the way they look, and each one is slightly different." And apparently at one time the copy desk had pulled some ore boat picture and used white out. They used to do this in the old days and whited out the name of the boat. And, you know, ran it with a story about a different boat, and everyone who saw that picture thought, you know, "Oh my God, that's my husband's boat." And it was so he was cautioning me that all ore boats are not the same. So when I started working on this book, the first thing I did was I made a timeline. So I called the News Tribune to get the dates of my hiring and my firing, or not firing, my quitting.
It's a different kind of book.
Yeah, no. Different ending. No, my hiring and my leaving dates. And then I started plugging in key events that I remembered. And then I looked up the Fitzgerald, and the Fitzgerald had sunk 6 months before I was hired.
Oh, my goodness.
So there went my memory, you know. And as it turned out, the memory was true. I did have this conversation with this copy editor, but it was not the day the Fitzgerald sank. It was a completely different day. So that was a warning to me that, you know, even though memoir is person's remembrances and memories of events, you can't just go by that.
Mm-hmm. I guess that gets into this next question I want to ask. And to me, Laura, your memoir is refreshingly truthful. There's no embellishments or incredible coincidences, David Sedaris.
Yeah.
Was this intentional? Are you trying not to end up on Oprah's couch?
Oh, there's nothing I would like more. And if she's listening, you can please give her my phone number. You know, it's not a tell-all. It's not scandalous. There's nothing, you know, if you're looking for, you know, dysfunction, you're not going to find it there. I wanted to tell the story as truly as I could, and I did a lot of research. I did write from memory, but I interviewed a lot of people that I used to work with. I tracked people down. You know, Facebook was great for that. I got very active on Facebook and found a lot of people. Did some phone interviews, did some face-to-face interviews. I reread old clips. I looked through old photos. And then as sort of a gold mine for the later chapters, a friend of mine who had worked with me in Duluth and then later moved up to the Anchorage Daily News up in Alaska, she had saved all the letters that I had written to her during my last few years at the News Tribune. And she brought them to work in this huge sack. And, you know, I can't believe how many letters I wrote and how long they were. They were 8 and 10 page letters, but they were so useful because then I could really remember exactly what was going on in the newsroom and, you know, what I was thinking about my career and that sort of thing. So I quote in the acknowledgments, I quote my father, who liked to say memory is slippery, and I used that as sort of my guide, not to just go by my memory.
We're talking with Laurie Hertzell, the author of News to Me, Adventures of an Accidental Journalist, published by the University of Minnesota Press. And I want to caution listeners that we're not, this is a recorded interview, we're not taking phone calls this morning. Well, let's jump into the book, Lori. Okay, May 11th, 1976, your very first day on the job as a newsroom clerk at the Duluth News Tribune. Mm-hmm. Can you remember that first day? How were you dressed? What were you feeling? What was it like when you walked into this bastion of bald men?
I remember the day really well. I do not remember what I was wearing, but I used to wear my hair. I have very frizzy, wild hair, and I didn't know what to do with it in those years, so I would braid it very tightly and pin the braids on top of my head, and then I had those gigantic kind of windshield glasses that everybody wore in the 1970s, and I was a poor student, and so my clothes mainly came from Goodwill, so I might have been wearing something from Goodwill or something left over from high school. But I remember walking up the stairs, and of course the newsroom was on the second floor, and it was already busy because the morning paper and the afternoon paper shared a newsroom. So the folks who were putting out the afternoon herald had already been at work for maybe 3 hours by the time I got there at 9 o'clock in the morning. So the copy desk was off to the side, and they were all working. The city editor, Fritz Nothacker, he came and got me, and he gave me a tour. And I remember just being just amazed by everything I saw. And, you know, some people have asked me how I could remember vivid details, but, you know, you have to remember this was my very first job, and it was so different from anything I had seen before in my 18 years of life, that it really did imprint on me. You know, the memories of, you know, maybe my middle years at the paper, you know, the mid-80s, they're not as vivid because by then it had just become routine. But that first day and that first year really stayed with me. And I remember Fritz giving me a tour of the newsroom, showing me the copy desk, showing me the wire machine. It had pale yellow paper, and all of the stories that moved on the wire typed on this yellow paper, and I was not entrusted with changing the paper roll. Only the copy desk could do that because they had to make sure that it never ran out of paper. Because if it ran out of paper, it would just keep typing the news on the empty platen, and you would miss all those stories. And he took me and showed me the executive offices and the publisher's office, and he had a beautiful office that looked over Lake Superior. And the presses were downstairs, and you know, we had a little lunchroom with vending machines, and there was a conference room, and all of this stuff was just mysterious and fascinating to me. And then he told me about benefits, and I had to, you know, remember, I was working for 95 cents an hour at the library, and benefits was like a new word for me. And when he told me that I would get paid even if I was sick and couldn't come to work, I just thought, like, this is a miracle.
What was a typical day for you those first few days? I mean, all of us that have started new jobs mm-hmm. find it extremely confusing to find where you fit in. How did you fit in? I mean, the time never stops at a newsroom. They're not going to say, well, now we're going to take the next 48 hours and teach Lori everything we know. Who did you hook on to, and were you doing obits at the time? Or?
It was mainly Fritz. Fritz was just a very kind man. He was super busy, but then the Herald was done. You know, the Herald was printed at 11:30 and came up off the press around noon. So after noon, he was able to spend a little bit of time with me. But I was kind of thrown into the fray immediately. I mean, you're right. It's not a newsroom is not a nurturing place, and it's not a place where you're eased into things. You're pretty much thrown into things. So the city desk at that time was two desks pushed together that faced each other, with a big wastebasket in between for all the press releases that we didn't want. And one of the desks was for Fritz, and he was the editor of the afternoon paper, and the other desk was for Jack, and he was the city editor of the morning paper. But he didn't come in until 3 in the afternoon. So I would sit at Jack's desk and answer the phone, and, taking obits was pretty easy. It was pretty formulaic. I just followed the style that we had in the paper. So that was my job for the first few days. I just answered the phone, took obits, opened the mail. I remember after I had been there a few months, the top editor came wandering out into the newsroom, and he was kind of standing there staring at me, and I didn't really know what he wanted. I was very young and very shy. And then he said, you're so serious. You need to loosen up a little, you know? Don't work so hard. Talk to people. And it was really the only time in my life that a boss has ever told me not to work hard. But I took it to heart, you know. Started talking to people.
And maybe you could tell our listeners about sort of the day or the days that you stopped making coffee. And coffee in those days was not running out to Starbucks. It was filling up this huge urn. And I believe you had to fill it up in the men's room or one of the restrooms.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Well, okay, keep in mind there were very few women on the second floor at all. The second floor was the newsroom, sports, and the composing room where they pasted up the sheets for the presses. And it was almost all men. So there was a big men's room. And then there was directly across the hall from the sports department, there was a door that led to the women's bathroom. And you open the door, and there was a toilet. It was just a door and a toilet and a little sink. And there was no fan, and there was no buffer space. And it was, I hated that room. It was very embarrassing because all the sports writers would know every time you had to go to the bathroom. But you couldn't fill up the coffee urn there because it was just a little tiny sink. And it was one of those huge urns like you see at, you know, picnics or
churches,
church parties. Yeah, those huge, and it was heavy, and I was, you know, I was a scrawny person. But it was supposedly my job to make coffee, and I didn't drink coffee. I didn't know what coffee was supposed to taste like. I didn't know how much water, how much coffee. And I was kind of annoyed by this because it just didn't seem like this should be part of my job. You know, I was contributing to the newspaper. I was writing obituaries. I was collecting the marine traffic twice a day. I was going across the street to the courthouse and getting the marriage licenses and the divorce decrees and the bankruptcies and that sort of thing. And making coffee really seemed like whoever drank the coffee should make the coffee. But I didn't say this because I'm a passive-aggressive Minnesotan and I was quite intimidated by all these people. So I just, you know, lugged the urn down to the men's room and pounded on the door and went in and filled it up and came back and made coffee. And apparently I made it so badly nobody could drink it. And nobody ever asked me to make coffee again.
Was it too weak or too strong?
I think it was too strong. Ah. I think I, like, put in half a can or something. But it wasn't on purpose, really. Or maybe it was.
Now, the papers eventually combined, I think, around 1980. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And is this when you were, in your own words, dragged silently screaming into the world of reporting?
Yes. I had gone from being the clerk. Actually, no, by then I think when the papers merged, yes, I was a reporter. That's true. I had gone from being a clerk to being the librarian for a couple of years. And while I was the librarian, I got in the habit of circling typos and misspellings that were in the paper and bringing them out to the copy desk, thinking in my foolish way that I was being helpful when really I was just being terribly annoying. Nobody wants to see an error after it's too late to fix it, and I didn't really think about that. I was just showing them so they could do better next time. And so at one point they finally said, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Do you want to work on the copy desk for a summer? And so I did. I filled in on the copy desk. And it was great. I loved it. I loved it. And when the summer was over, a job opened up, and I moved over into that job permanently and left the library behind, which was great because I thought the library was quite boring. So I was a copy editor for a few years. And then, yes, I got moved into reporting against my will. I had no interest in being a reporter. I barely knew how to drive. I was very shy. I used to watch what the reporters did and just be absolutely amazed by it. And I kept thinking I could never do that. I could never do what they do. And I felt so safe on the copy desk just, you know, editing their copy and laying out the pages and working with the printers and getting the paper out the door in the morning. But we had a reporter on staff who could not make deadline. She was just sort of deadline phobic. She was a good reporter. She was a good writer, but deadlines just paralyzed her.
That could be a problem.
That is a huge problem.
Yes.
And she happened to be dating the head of the copy desk, and he wanted to help her save her job because he knew her job was in peril. So he met with the managing editor, and they came up with this new rule. And the rule was all copy editors should have reporting experience. And I was the only one who didn't. So they moved me into reporting, ostensibly because they had this new rule, but then they moved her onto the copy desk where he could kind of look after her and make sure that she did okay. And it was, I was terrified.
Now, before we move on to the Iron Range, which was your mm-hmm. your beat, copy editing, I've always sensed from working with you, is a passion with you.
It was at the time, but again, you know, I'm not sure I would want to do it now, although, you know, who knows? I could try it and see. I loved it then because it was, again, it was such a new world for me. And one thing I loved was reading the wires because we got the Knight Ridder wire, which was these beautiful, well-told, you know, deadline stories. They were just stupendous. You'd get the breaking news on the AP wire, and then if you waited an hour or two, you'd get another version of the same story just told as a great tale. And I just devoured these things. And I loved reading, you know, everything that was going on in the world. I thought it was fascinating. And as I was learning news judgment, you know, I would pick and choose which wire stories were going to make the paper. And then the head of the copy desk would look over my shoulder and kind of correct me. And this is one of the ways that I learned news judgment. And then I would go home. I'd go home around midnight or 1 in the morning, and I would turn on Linda Ellerbee's NBC News Overnight. Do you remember that show?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. And I'd sit on my couch and I would watch her and she would give the top headlines and I would compare what I had picked for the paper with what she was putting on the air. And so that kind of helped hone my news judgment too. It was a great job. I really loved it. You know, we were all very young. It's kind of astounding when you think about it now. I was, you know, in my early 20s by then. The other copied editors were all, they were in their 20s. Maybe a couple of them were in their early 30s. And after about 7 o'clock, we were the only people there, and we called all the shots.
We're talking with Laurie Herzl, the author of News to Me, Adventures of an Accidental Journalist, available everywhere. Fine books are sold, but it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Now, your first beat was the Iron Range, and what did that consist of geographically, and who lived there? And describe that. I'm giving you multiple questions like you're the president and I'm doing a press conference here, but describe that first phone call for your first assignment.
Okay, the Iron Range is, it's northern Minnesota, mostly northeastern Minnesota, all the way to the Canadian border. There are actually 3 Iron Ranges. And they are, you know, where the taconite mines are now and the underground mines were back in the day. And it was settled, you know, around the turn of the 20th century by Finns and Polacks and Italians and some Swedes and Germans. And, you know, they came here and made farms and started mining. And it's a very very interesting area. It's settled all by immigrants, but the people who lived there when I was reporting up there had no desire to move again. It was like any sense of adventure had played out, you know, with their grandparents, and now they loved it up there, and they went hunting and fishing, and, you know, it's a very beautiful part of the state, deep forests and big lakes. And I would say that my beat went from Duluth west to Grand Rapids, Minnesota, north to the Canadian border, and then also northern Wisconsin and a little bit of upper Michigan. So it was a big area to cover. And it, you know, we would check out staff cars and then go, you know, go driving for stories and be gone sometimes overnight. Usually you had to get more than one story to justify a road trip, but it was a lot of, you know, out of the office, meeting people, seeing new places, you know, learning about this kind of interesting small-town life.
And your first assignment? You made a phone call. It didn't quite go as you had planned.
No, it didn't. I was very briefly married in the early 80s, and I had always said when I was a kid that when I got married, you know, I was always sort of a feminist, I guess, even before that word had been coined. And I had said, from the time I was a kid that when I got married, I was going to hyphenate my name with my husband's name. So then I married a man whose name was Schlappenbach.
Schlappenbach.
Yeah, so my name was Lori Herzl Schlappenbach.
It just slides off the tongue.
If you practice it, it does, although the copy editors used to make fun of it and call me Schlesling Holstein or whatever that. But anyway, and another one shortened my name to Herzbach. He thought that worked better.
It's not bad.
That's not bad. But my first assignment, you know, and I probably wouldn't have hyphenated my name if I had known that it would send my byline onto two lines, because you can't fit that whole thing onto one line. But my first assignment was to call this old woman who lived near the University of Minnesota up in Duluth, and she rented rooms to college students. And it was just, you know, one of those easy little feature stories. Here's this sweet woman, and, you know, hear her tales of renting to students and nightmares and, you know, why she did it and what was good about it. So I called her up, and I was very scared. I was very nervous. I just didn't think I should be doing this job. I wasn't qualified. I didn't know what I was doing. The newspaper had, the Afternoon Herald had folded, and so the newspaper had a new name. It was now the News Tribune and Herald, so it also had a hyphenated name. So I called this woman, and I kind of blurted out very quickly, you know, this is Lori Herzl Schlappenbach from the News Tribune and Herald. And there was this pause, and then this old woman's voice said, "Honey, I can't understand a word you just said." and I really thought about just slamming the phone down and telling my editor, "I can't do the story, the woman's dead." But instead, I slowed down and said it again. And I did the story. It was not a great story, but I did the story.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn from covering that beat? I know in the book you talk about good story, stupid story, stories about people who made crafts in their senior citizen apartments, mm-hmm. stories about women raised llamas, stories about kids with sad, untreatable diseases, or Native American women who braided rugs to sell. Mm-hmm. What was that you came away from after covering that beat?
Well, you have to understand, I grew up in a family, you know, big family. It was sort of its own society. You know, when you get a family that big, there's 12 people in a house. You have your own rules. You have your own ways of doing things. You have your own rituals. There isn't a lot of room for other people. And what that first beat did was it really opened me up to all the different ways of living that there are, you know, just in, you know, 50 miles from my house. It got me inside other people's houses. It forced me to meet people and be friendly. It forced me to listen to them in an open way, not judging them, not thinking, well, that's not how we do it, you know, which might be a natural reaction of somebody in my situation. It really got me to pay attention to people's stories, and I am just eternally grateful for that. I used to say if I ever wrote a book, it would be called Journalism Saved Me. And, of course, that's a terrible title, and it's a little dramatic, too. But in a way, it did. I mean, when you're reporting, especially that kind of story, those human interest stories, even if they're sort of silly topics, you know, like the guy who made crafts in his apartment, you learn something from them. You learn what makes people tick. You learn, you know, what's interesting about people. You start understanding people's passions. And I remember that guy in particular. He's not in the book, but he was just such a kind man. And his passion was, I mean, it was goofy. He made these little miniature chairs out of pieces of sheet metal. And then he would go to Goodwill and buy clothes, mainly, you know, velvet and kind of tactile clothes, fabrics, and make little cushions for the chairs. And he had this, you know, very ordinary, bland, kind of modern senior citizen high-rise that he lived in. And his apartment was covered in these little chairs, and these little metal chairs with little red velvet cushions, you know, on the tabletops and on his bookcases and in his windowsills. And he was really passionate about this. And, you know, did I learn anything useful from him? No, but I remember how excited he was and how much he wanted to share what he did and the stories he told about, you know, friends of his knew that if they had any nice fabric they were getting rid of, you know, they should give it to him because he would turn it into something beautiful. And you know, it was poignant. And I never forgot him.
Hmm. The trip to Russia seems to be a beautiful section of the book. It's a wonderful section about traveling to Russia with the sister city contingent from Duluth. What made you want to go? You were so passionate about going. You were almost a pest to your editor because for this newspaper to send anybody even outside of Minnesota was a big deal. But to send you to Russia, how did this come about?
I'm still not sure how it came about. there was this group of Duluthians, this very good-hearted group of people, and it was an interesting group because it was all kinds of people. There was a former provost of UMD, and there were a couple of professors. There were some school kids, you know, as young as 13. All they were led by a minister, Brooks Anderson, whose idea this was to establish a sister city in the Soviet Union. This was 1986. You know, the Cold War was still going on. There was no internet. There was no email. There was no easy way to communicate with the Soviet Union. But he was determined, and in a very gentle way. He's not, you know, a fire and brimstone preacher. He's really a quiet, soft-spoken guy who leads by example and lets other people have the limelight if they want it, but he knows what he wants to accomplish. He's a great man, I think. And Brooks got this group of people together, and they met every week, all summer long, talking about how they wanted to establish this sister city with a city named Petrozavodsk in northern Russia. They wrote letters to the mayor, got no answer. They sent telexes, they got no answer. And finally they decided, we're just going to go there. We're just going to show up. I mean, this may not sound very astounding today when, you know, travel is so easy and Russia is not seen as the evil empire and you can email anybody on the planet. But in those days, it was really an astounding thing for him to suggest. And the fact that they actually went through with it was pretty amazing. So, yeah, I went to my editor repeatedly and said, you know, you've got to send me. You've got to send me. And you know, to his credit, he didn't say, you're crazy. He pretty much just didn't say anything, which came in handy because, you know, it's easier to seek forgiveness than permission. So I just kind of went, and it was really an amazing trip.
And there's a Finnish connection, right, between
yes,
the two cities?
There is. There are a lot of Finns in Duluth and on the Iron Range. And they came here in the 20s after the Finnish Civil War. The socialists lost the Civil War, and a lot of them came to America, and a lot of them settled on the Iron Range. Not all the Finns on the range are socialists by any means, but a lot of them are. And there were, you know, a lot of co-ops on the range. Gus Hall is from the range. And in the 1930s, a big number of them, perhaps as many as 6,000 or 7,000 of them, moved to the Soviet Union to help build communism. You know, Lenin put out the call, socialists of the world unite, and a lot of them showed up. And so we did not really understand that when we went there, but as chance would have it, the city that Brooks and his folks had chosen as Duluth's sister city, Petrozavodsk, is the very place where a lot of these Finns went in the 1930s. And so when we got off the train in Petrozavodsk in the morning, the September kind of rainy morning when we got there, there were all these old people on the platform who came up to us, and they were holding flowers, and they said, they spoke to us in English, and they said, hello, Duluth, does the aerial bridge still go up and down? Are the hills still green? And it was really amazing. And they were the children of those immigrant Finns who had come in the 30s and brought their children with them, and now the children were grown, and they had been in the Soviet Union all their lives.
And didn't their parents, in many instances, meet a tragic end?
Mostly the fathers did.
The fathers.
The fathers did. The fathers were taken away and slaughtered by Stalin, who did not trust foreign-born. So even though they moved there voluntarily to help build the country, they brought money with them, they brought equipment with them, they brought logging equipment, they brought all kinds of stuff. They built the town of Petrozavodsk. They built some of the surrounding towns, and then they were taken away and killed.
We're talking with Laurie Hertzell, the author of News to Me, Adventures of an Accidental Journalist, published by University of Minnesota Press. And I want to remind callers that, well, there are no callers because we're tape recording this at an earlier time. I want to switch gears a little bit from your book and ask you some questions about where newspaper journalism is headed. Recently, I read that the state of Kansas was eliminating funding from its high school journalism programs because they feel that, quote, journalism in its present form at least will not be a viable profession in the future. Yet a new survey by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press says that U.S. citizens are spending 57 minutes a day getting news from print newspapers, radio, television, about the same amount as 10 years ago, plus an additional 13 minutes from getting news online. So that's about 70 minutes a day. Where are newspapers headed in the face of all this citizen journalism, the blogging, the texting, the 24/7 cable, Twitter, internet world that we're all participating in? Do you have any idea? I mean, the Star Tribune seems like a great survivor. It has, the 10th largest Sunday circulation of a Sunday newspaper in the nation. They must be doing some things right.
Well, I think we are. You know, I had not heard that about Kansas, and I think that's very short-sighted and very sad because we will always need journalists. I do not think you can have a thriving democracy without a strong free press that sheds light on what's going on, that is a watchdog of the government and of civil rights. I just don't think that we can flourish without that. And I don't think that we are headed in that direction. I think people are very interested in the news. You know, as far as print goes, I don't think the problem is lack of readers. The problem is lack of advertisers. That really is what is hurting newspapers. There are people who read newspapers online. They read them in print. They're hungry for information. Advertisers are finding that there are other places that they can go. They're targeting their ads more. They're getting more sophisticated as to, you know, what you buy and what you might buy, might be persuaded to buy. And so, you know, these big blanket ads that go to everybody perhaps are not seen as quite as efficient. But I don't think the problem is lack of readership. At my paper, we are doing things very well. I think, you know, we went through a rocky time a few years ago. We had owners who did not understand newspapers. They drove us into bankruptcy. Of course they didn't mean to. Nobody would do that on purpose, but it was a terrible time. They're gone. We have new owners. And things have really stabilized. We've hired some people. We have not cut space. I'm feeling particularly blessed that we have not cut space for book reviews. I have a lot of space every week, as much as I ever had. And I think that our top bosses made very sensible decisions in not cutting space. And, you know, they had to cut on the production end, which makes it, you know, very difficult for those folks, and they're always strapped. But they made a decision not to just, you know, cut a little bit everywhere, but to cut deep in one place so that we could allow space and writing to flourish. The paper across the river, the Pioneer Press, which is where my husband works, I think they have also stabilized. They went through a fairly rocky time, too, and lost a lot of staff. But there haven't been any layoffs there for quite some time, and I think they're actually starting to add staff back again. So I'm very hopeful.
What's happening with the newspaper in Duluth?
The newspaper in Duluth was bought by Forum Communications, which owns the Fargo Forum. You know, a lot of these newspapers had been Knight Ridder papers, and the Knight Ridder chain was, you know, back in the day, that was the Cadillac of chains. That was a wonderful chain, and it no longer exists. So those smaller regional papers like the Duluth paper and the Fargo paper, they've sort of become a chain unto themselves. And, you know, it's smaller, but Duluth is also smaller than it was when I was there. When I was in Duluth, it was, you know, about 100,000 people, and now I think it's down to about 80,000. And the paper has also shrunk, but it, you know, it's still there. It still comes out. I still have friends who work there.
Is it odd publishing a book and yet you can't really assign it for review? Your book.
It, you know, it is. It's when I took over the books pages 2 years ago, I made some changes in how we did things. You know, in the 14 years I've been here at the Star Tribune, we've had four or five different books editors, and each one has put his own imprint on the page and his own philosophy of what kinds of books deserve reviewing. And what I have done is put a premium on regional books because, you know, there's just a wealth of great publishers here and so many writers. I mean, we have, you know, really well-known writers. Neil Gaiman lives here. Robert Bly lives here. Louise Erdrich lives here. Garrison Keillor lives here. But there's also, you know, really, really talented writers who maybe aren't quite as well-known, who might publish with smaller presses. And I really try to play them up and give them attention because they're not going to get reviewed everywhere. And I believe they should be reviewed here because this is where they live and this is where people read them. So my book, you know, which is by a local writer about a very local topic, you know, published by local press, is exactly the kind of book I would normally review on my pages. But clearly I can't. You know, I can't send my own book out for review. There isn't any ethical way that could possibly be done. So it will not be reviewed in the Star Tribune.
How about the Pioneer Press?
Well, you know, they did not review it, and I think that their books editor is, you know, there used to be a very, very strong competition between these two papers, and it's kind of gone away, I think, in the last few years, but I think maybe she doesn't think that. So she said she was not going to review my book.
Hmm. Well, that's too bad.
It's okay. She mentioned it. She did a big roundup last week of, you know, books that are coming out this fall. So I did get a sentence.
Mm-hmm. Well, a sentence is better than
it is
than nothing.
That, it is.
Because it could go viral. You never know.
That viral sentence.
Finally, I feel that news to me, at least, it was two things. It was certainly a Valentine for journalism, print journalism, and also a beautiful, almost a love poem for Duluth.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the newspaper part, could you close out our show by reading the last paragraph on page 203? Because I think it really sums up some of the passion that you feel for newspapers and, of course, the men and women who work in them. I won't say toil, though there is some toiling involved. you can't dispel toiling because there is toiling. But I wonder if you would read that last paragraph for us.
Sure. The paragraph before that, I'm talking about all the changes that you have mentioned already, the blogs and videos and internet and all of that, and how it's affecting newspapers. And then I wrote, "It's anybody's guess if these changes will save the Star Tribune or will save any newspaper. And everyone is guessing and posting their guesses all over the internet. Me, I keep my head down, do my work, enjoy the hubbub and bustle of the Daily Miracle, and fervently hope it lasts. When big news happens, Paul Wellstone's plane goes down, terrorists fly into the Twin Towers, the Interstate 35W bridge collapses into the Mississippi River in a heap of concrete dust and screams, nobody does a better job of coverage, and there is no place I want to be but the newsroom."
And do you still feel that way?
Oh, yes.
You're still excited to go to work, and even though there isn't the blue plume of cigarette smoke anymore or the...
Those
the urns.
Those stories that I mentioned, I helped on the coverage of all of them. You know, Paul Wellstone's plane went down on my birthday. It was the worst birthday of my life. And, you know, after the Twin Towers, I was there every day, night after night after night, late at night, editing. You know, we had pages and pages of these stories of pain and sorrow, you know, the people that had, you know, were looking for loved ones or had lost loved ones. And the I-35 bridge, you know, I worked on that as well with projects and a big narrative that we did the Sunday after the bridge collapse that I edited. And there's, you know, you feel like you're doing something important. You're helping people understand what happened. You're bringing them information that they really want. And And it's hard work. And, you know, you can't look at the clock. You're there till midnight, night after night. You know, it doesn't matter. No, I still feel that way. I think I'll always feel that way.
We've just had a great conversation with Lori Herzl, the writer of News to Me, the author of News to Me, Adventures of an Accidental Journalist, published this fall by University of Minnesota Press. I certainly will recommend it to everybody. I think it's one of the sleepers of the season. We can dispel Jonathan Franzen and turn to Lori Herzl for a great book about newspaper journalism. And Lori, I've certainly enjoyed this conversation with you today, and I wish you the very best of luck with the book and your career.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it too.
Thank you very much.